So what gives you conviction that this time is different?
That's Shaq, a partner at Lux Capital. If you haven't heard of Lux, they're a $5 billion fund. They've invested in startups like Databricks, Anduril, Ramp, just to name a few. Shaq has been there for 5 years as a partner. Before that, he was an engineer at NASA and Northrop Grumman. Now me, the founder that's pitching Shaq.
I disagree with the premise that automation has not paid off for the capital expenditure.
That's why he's worked at Google and Apple and founded multiple startups. Feather Robotics is flipping robotics on its head.
So we're building a general purpose robot similar to Tesla or bigger. We're a lot simpler because we're trying to build a form factor that's at the intersection of simplicity and capability. And this allows us to bring the cost down.
Here's one of my favorite questions that Shaq asked. The
question that's going through my head right now is around value capture. Mm-hmm. In order to build a large generational company, there are two axes most people think about this through. First and foremost, you have to...
This part of his framework is understanding, can this actually be a massive company? Check out the next part.
What is ultimately your right to win as you see the entire sort of value chain kind of building across? And what keeps you up at night? What are the competitors that you sort of worry about?
After Hua left, Shaq shared the answer that he was actually looking for. Check it out.
When I bring up other companies in their broad value chain, the top decile founders are the ones who navigate through all of that. They're obsessed. They're paying attention to every little clip and everything that comes out of it. And they understand exactly what they're building and how it...
And state of the end, because he also shares this.
The founders that most resonate with me are the ones when I bring up other...
I'm Adam O'Donnell. This is the Founder Initiative, and I want you to become one of those founders that most resonates with a VC like Shaq. Now for the pitch.
So we're building a general purpose robot, similar to Tesla or bigger. System's different because we do two things different. We're a lot simpler because we're trying to build a form factor that's at the intersection of simplicity and capability. And this allows us to bring the cost down. And second thing that we're different is we're focusing on third-party developers like physical AI companies and manufacturing integrators instead of doing the entire tech stack ourselves. We're trying to build kind of like the Apple or Nvidia for a new product class or hardware class.
What are your first thoughts?
Very interesting, very ambitious. Obviously, the names that you cite, you know, NVIDIA, Tesla, yeah, Apple, et cetera, are all like generational companies, right? So it tells me my initial thoughts are he obviously has large ambition and aspirations trying to build something. There are several questions obviously going through my head that we can kind of dig into. I also get a feeling that you're aware of other attempts in the market, like you mentioned specific names. You also made a couple of comments regarding how you kind of segment between where your capabilities are and where you expect other companies in the startup ecosystem to be playing a role, which shows, I guess, some aspect of self-awareness. So those are some of the initial kind of candid thoughts that were going through my head.
I love that. And what would be your very first question?
Well, one of the things here is that I have domain experience. Mm-hmm. Like I've seen several companies in this space. So my question is probably a little bit more pointed than maybe someone who is sort of asking about it. I would say some of the things that I'd love to understand are, first of all, why are you building this? You know, in the context of like your background, why is this the thing you're singularly, you know, we always talk about the best founders are missionaries, not mercenaries, right? So trying to understand a bit of like, what is it about this problem that really uniquely draws you to it?
So I think you have to go all the way back to my childhood. Hmm. So my family moved here when I was 2 years old. And my parents I have 7 siblings, so they were taking care of 8 kids in a family, and only my mom worked for close to minimum wage. And my parents didn't speak English, so they didn't know about social services in the US. So they were just trying to take care of us with the money they had, and they were trying to make rent. And so for some weeks or months, when trying to make rents, they didn't have money for other luxuries such as food. And I would only have rice and fish sauce to eat for several meals for like a week. And then I would be like, you will always ask yourself, why does like poverty exist? What are the factors that like, why isn't everybody taken care of in this world? And this is something that's like, I was malnourished as a kid, and it's kind of like made me think a lot throughout history. And I realized that there's 6 major bottlenecks in society. And the 6 major bottlenecks are energy, materials, labor, physical capital, governance, and we actually have a sustainability budget in our society. And when I was thinking about that, a lot of these problems can be solved if we actually created infinite labor. Because with infinite labor, we can create infinite energy, and then we can also have the resources to mine as much resources as we want. And I realized that, hey, we can give everybody a high quality of life if we actually solved infinite labor.
Wow. Well, thank you for sharing that story, first of all. Yeah. Very, very powerful. And look, I think when we think about the world historically, economics has taught us this idea of scarcity, and it's taught us that the way we ultimately create value is to take things that are scarce and try to make them as abundant as we possibly can. So it really feels like a lot of the things you're touching on are sort of along that theme, but in a way that physical labor historically has been sort of something that's there's a finite amount of it, right? And your ability to really kind of try and democratize it and sort of scale it up is sort of a novel kind of insight into something that without technology would probably be we'd be unable to do. So
And to add on to that, I think that historically we've been limited by the number of humans in society and the average productivity of every single human. And I think that what's really exciting about this industry is like we can easily scale to billions of robots or general purpose robots to actually provide value to unlock this physical labor. So I think it's a purely value creation market.
So you touched on there are a few other folks who have the same vision or share this vision with you. Now, I think the way you segmented yourself from those companies is you're going after a different type of labor, it seems like, or at least maybe there's a specific use case or application that you have in mind that maybe is unappreciated by some of the companies like the Teslas and the Figures of the world. Can you expand on that a little bit to help me understand?
I think that we're approaching the go-to-market very differently from our competitors. And let me tell you a story first before I go into detail of why we're approaching it differently. So I was actually looking into starting a physical AI startup before and not going into hardware at all, because every single VC, as you know, have been burned by hardware, as they say. But it's a lot easier. The capital markets for software is a lot easier. But I realized at the end of the day, I was trying to look for a system to deploy my AI models off of for like restaurants. And I realized that there's no system on the market that is actually that actually works for entrepreneurs or that works for other companies. A lot of them are designed for either research labs, but they're not designed for 24/7 usage, or they're way too expensive where entrepreneurs do not have any margins working off of it. And then the third part is they're too complex and they're not ready yet for monetization anytime soon. Because even for like a legged humanoid, you need a whole body controller, and that adds a lot of error when you're controlling it. And I chatted with, it wasn't just me, I chatted with all my roboticist friends, and I realized they all had the same problem as well. And we always say that this market is saturated, but it's kind of funny because when you're chatting with all the roboticists, they're like, no, there's no options on the market. So I realized that, hey, there's every company like Figure or Tesla, they're doing vertical integration themselves. They're looking for these big customers, and then they're focusing on solving these big customers, and they get tied down onto the same problem for like 1 to 2 years for these one customer. And robotics fundamentally and labor fundamentally has a last mile problem. And that's what we saw in software, and we saw in all these other platforms like GPUs, computers. And it was actually this huge community of developers that actually solved all the edge cases for these problems. And I realized that, hey, robotics will probably be the same. We're going to have this general purpose platform, but it's going to be the huge community of physical AI companies that will spin up over the next 3 to 5 years that will solve all the labor domains. And how you're going to win this space is you're going to be the best platform for everybody else to build on top of. So you focus less on doing vertical integration yourself, but you focus more on helping other companies succeed.
Okay, so you mentioned a few things there, one of which is like the platform sort of that you ultimately want to provide and letting the actual physical AI companies sort of step in and take over. Can you make that a little bit more concrete for me? Can you help me understand a bit of like what is the sort of unique insight, or what have you actually built thus far, and who then leverages it? Like, what's an example of a customer that would ultimately then step in here?
Yes. So I have a video that I can show you of the system we built. We started this company at the beginning of this year, and the system that we built in 2 months. So I can kind of like, would you like to see the video? Yes, I just asked it to do it something it's able to understand. And how we designed this robot is we try to design it at the intersection of simplicity as well as capabilities, because we're trying to build a system that's monetizable next year rather than monetizable in 3 to 5 years. And we actually are taking an approach that's similar to companies like Apple in the past, where they actually just built a better system on a yearly cadence based on what was commercially ready at the time, rather than trying to like shoot for the moon at the very beginning. So
everything from a hardware perspective that I'm looking at, is that all like commercial off the shelf, like components? Is there any sort of where does the value prop of your company ultimately live in that?
I think we designed the form factor.
Okay.
So we take the actuators, which is off the shelves, mm-hmm. but a lot of everything else is actually custom designed mechanically. Like we design our own wheel system so they can drive side to side. We design our custom lift so it can go up and down very fast. And we design our own arm as well. So we only take like raw components from these companies. And how we try to look at it is like there's a lot of form factor, because form factor is what defines like how humans are shaped and mm-hmm. what kind of tasks humans can do. So we kind of like iterate on the form factor section. And the second area we live is on the developer API, because we're not just a hardware company. We're actually a full solutions platform. And by that, we actually write software, because one thing we notice is a lot of companies, they're re-implementing the same control stack. They're re-implementing the same like teleoperation stack. And we notice that this takes startups like a year to launch, because they're just like, I can name so many startups that's building teleoperation stacks. Mm-hmm. And if we just created something that's like publicly available for everybody to get started up and running quickly, then the cost, the time to market for these physical AI startups goes from 2 years to 3 months.
Okay. Can you give me like an example, maybe just to kind of bring this home? Like what would be like your perfect example of a customer, and like where does their value prop ultimately sit above the stack of things that you're providing to them?
Okay. So yeah, let me talk about one of my ideal customers. All right. So let's say I have there's a physical AI startup. They have a team of software engineers and they need a hardware system to do machine. Have you heard of like stamping machines at factories?
Mm-hmm.
So basically for medium-sized factories, they can't afford full automation solutions, but they usually have like 6 to 10 stamping machines a lot of times because they still have some scale. So right now they're usually hiring about 20 employees to man those stamping machines. And we can probably replace that with like 20 of our robots. And so the startup wants to kind of like solve this software problem, and they need a hardware solution on top of it. And right now we're like the only solution that can kind of like, you can actually bring to the factory. It can work throughout the whole day without like, because if you buy a Unitree robot, you have to charge it, you have to keep it plugged in, and it can kind of, but they want to just focus on the software layer. And that's why they would buy our system, so that they can focus on the software layer, they can focus on collecting the data they need, and then deploying the system to a factory.
So in this example, just to make sure I'm fully appreciating it, wouldn't the customer in a perfect world get the full solution, like not having to do even the software itself? Don't they ultimately just want to buy like an answer to a problem versus having to do some have to work themselves?
I agree. And that's why we're building a developer API that becomes more capable over time. And I think that one of the biggest mistakes people do is they try to solve every single problem at once. And even when you looked at the history of like, let's say Mac OS, they actually just started with hardware at the very beginning. And you had to put in these CD-ROMs because they weren't building the software. And it wasn't until like 5 years later that they started adding software. And the first companies that was building on top of them was VisiCalc, which was the spreadsheet. And what we find is even the successful companies like Apple, DJI, all these companies, they add one system at a time, but they add reliable systems that brought down the cost of integration. And we're going in that direction too. We continue to add more systems that makes it easier for all of our customers to automate physical labor, but we have to do the systems that we set out to do first well. And if we try to do everything at the very beginning, which all these other companies are trying to do, this is their biggest mistake. This is why they need hundreds of millions of dollars to tackle these problems. And this is why we can operate leanly and profitably at the very start by having intense focus.
Got it. Yeah, one of the most, you referenced Apple earlier, and I think they're an interesting kind of example to think about when you think about this idea of vertical integration mm-hmm. in service to trying to build an ultimate platform. I think an example that a lot of people are familiar with is the iPhone.
Yeah.
When you think about what the release of the App Store was sort of an opportunity for Apple to leverage their existing ecosystem of understanding the hardware, understanding the integration of the operating system, and then being able to uniquely leverage the actual application layer itself.
Yeah.
Now, there's sort of this chicken and egg problem, as you alluded to earlier, that if you want developers to ultimately come on, they need to believe that the install base of devices that's available is sufficiently large because they want to amortize their development costs across as many users as they possibly can. And if you only have a very small subset of robots in the market, it's hard to justify third parties to come on and actually build on there. Now, if you can ultimately be opinionated, at least early on, as Apple and sort of other companies were, to show these are examples, representative applications, that creates the sort of imagination of new developers to come on and say, what if this existed? What if this existed? And that kind of ultimately creates that. So the way you get around this cold start problem, I think, is you want to ultimately be opinionated about what those early use cases are. So whether it's stamping robots, whether it's other examples, and use that to then create the imagination of the net new use cases that you and your team may not necessarily ultimately be able to deliver on, but others can kind of come on and build. I'm curious how that resonates with you.
I think we were doing exactly that. This is why we're focusing deeply on manufacturing integrators. So the reason why, so when we say physical AI companies, they can just take hardware and they don't need this developer API because they have the technical skills in-house. So we don't have to do any additional work when we're selling just hardware to physical AI companies. Now, when we're building this developer API, we're deeply focused on manufacturing integrators and these factory applications from machine tending to cloning, stamping, to inventory management and material handling. And we've already signed 6 LOIs with such companies. So we see that there's a strong demand for this system on the market, and this is where we're intensely focused.
And if a customer were to come to you and ultimately position their ideal form factor as sort of different than the reference architecture you just sort of showed me, how does that then, how does that change? Like how, like, does that ultimately then require a new rewriting of the software in order to then service them? Like you have to imagine the number of use cases out there. If we think about physical labor today, it's more than we can possibly talk about on this podcast. So how do you sort of tackle that initially? How do you hold the design of the hardware constant while allowing customers to ultimately get the productivity gains that they're hoping for?
And how we think about it is we think about, let's build a system that can do what humans can do, right? And if there's like a specialized robot that doesn't really perform how a human interacts with the world, maybe a specialized robot would be a better solution for them.
Yeah, right? I always think about like the Star Wars example, where in Star Wars, you've got a robot that does each job sort of purpose built. And then a lot of the other kind of competitors that you cited earlier, they have this very traditional sort of bimodal, bipedal kind of distribution of robots. And the assumption is that flexibility is ultimately what they're kind of solving for. So I find that this is almost like a philosophical debate right now in the world of robotics. And I'm curious if where you land on that.
I think that both are important. I don't think that humanoid robots will replace like a dishwasher, which is a specialized robot, but we're the glue with dishwashers, and they have different purposes and different roles. So where humanoids excel is in mobile intermittent tasks. And you can classify as intermittent as things that aren't done often, but they might be done at multiple stations. And right now we don't really have good automation solutions for that. And this is where humanoids robots shines particularly in the market, and they serve as the glue with other machines. So I think that we're going to see a society where both systems succeed. The reason why I actually like general purpose more is I think it's a much bigger market fundamentally, because what we're going to see in the next 5 years is embodied AI capabilities explode. And in that case, then we're going to have robots that's able to fulfill roles that humans are able to fulfill today. And we already know that there's billions of roles, physical labor roles, that humans fulfill. So there's no shortage of jobs that I'm worried about for this market opportunity. And one thing that we've seen with specialized robots is a lot of times they tap out at like these tens of billions of dollars in market cap. And the reason why I come from a software background, and the reason why I'm pursuing general purpose robots is I think this is one of the biggest market opportunities of our time.
Kind of just zoom out for one thing. Like what is the assumption that you're putting on him right now?
Question that's going through my head right now is around value capture. Mm-hmm. In order to build a large generational company, there are two axes most people will think about this through. First and foremost, you have to create a lot of value and value creation. There are a lot of things, we can talk about open source software, for example, or a lot of values created. Now, the other aspect that's also important is ultimately how much of that do you capture yourself? And that can vary greatly based on the type of company. In the world of providing hardware or hardware to a customer, there is generally a CapEx like sale that's ultimately done. Mm-hmm. And you find what are your unit costs. And you earlier mentioned why VCs historically have shied away from things like hardware. One of the reasons why we're even having this conversation today is that AI has sort of caused people to come back to the table, and they're saying, wait a second, what does it really take to build robotic intelligence? And if that were to exist, what are the markets we can ultimately go after? And we think about the total addressable market of physical labor at large, you're talking about trillions of economic value to go after, probably the largest market we've ever seen. So,
that's the macro shift that made hardware more.
It makes it more exciting again. Yeah, I think it makes people want to say, wait a second, maybe we should look at this again. But to your point, who ultimately wins in that sort of stack is still unclear. And there are a lot of folks that are trying to build the quote unquote open AI of robotics, right? The entire intelligence layer, some folks believe they can abstract that away from the actual form factor itself. And in some ways, these guys might be your competitors. So I guess where my question is landing is, what is ultimately your right to win as you see the entire sort of value chain kind of building across, and what keeps you up at night? What are the competitors that you sort of worry about?
So I don't think I'm worried about competitors fundamentally in this market, because I think that the market is, for the next 10 years, it's a purely value capture market. As long as you build a product that works, there's so many labor domains that you can go after, and it's going to be supply bottleneck. So I don't, the only thing that I worry about is our company burns through capital to a point where...
I guess the question is I'll name two companies that are currently highly funded, capitalized, and trying to build intelligence. We'll use physical intelligence and skill as sort of two examples. Where do they sit in this stack?
They're our customer rather than our competitor. So we're not trying to build a foundation model. We're trying to build a hardware platform for them to build on top of, because at the end of the day, they're going to need to monetize their foundation models, and they're going to need to deploy thousands of robots to the market. And right now they're buying robots from researchers, but these robots that they're buying have not been tested for 365 day usage, and they're going to break in the field. And when they need a reliable system to go into the market, we want to establish that reputation that, hey, we're the only viable solution at the price point that they need, with the features that they need, and that's easy for them to build on top of, and they can just scale deployment of their AI algorithms immediately.
So when you think about going back, and this is why this idea of value capture is so important, the defensibility of someone who has built the foundation model has generated, you know, billions, if not trillions, of tokens. They've done the thankless work of trying to create the models. They've fundamentally tried to create, or maybe in this case succeeded creating, the idea of the intelligence layer. So when you think about the most valuable part of the stack, my bias is to say that that is the most valuable part of the stack. And once that part of the stack has been built, everyone who is currently building hardware today will ultimately become in some ways commoditized. And they're all going to ultimately try and vertically integrate that intelligence layer into their products to make the most compelling value prop for their customers. So I worry about defensibility of ultimately what you're building. Earlier, you mentioned you're not necessarily worried about competition, but I'm actually... that's sort of where my head is thinking about at the moment, is everyone becomes a competitor at that world. Everyone who's currently building hardware today, everything from a Roomba all the way up to a Boston Robotics device, everyone will ultimately have to work with one of the small number of companies that will ultimately create embodied intelligence and vertically integrate that into their product.
So I disagree that hardware will be commoditized anytime soon. And I disagree with, and I'll explain my reasoning. But then I think our moat actually comes from multiple layers. Our moat isn't just a hardware layer. Our moat is a logistics layer. Our moat is, we'll dive deeper into that. But first of all, I think that one thing we might actually see is a lot of these foundation models, they might end up being commoditized, because we have multiple companies working on these foundation models from OpenAI, physical intelligence, skilled AI, and there's also open source ones.
And why do you think they're going to get commoditized beyond just the fact that there's multiple companies working on it? Like, maybe a click deeper into the actual limitation around how much physical world data we actually have access to relative to something like text that we had available abundantly on the internet.
So it's kind of like making a thesis that, hey, one of these companies, they're gonna have exclusive access to all this data, right? And I think that's let's say there is only one company that has exclusive access to this data. What we see is these exclusive access only lasts for a couple years maximum. Like, I think that we haven't seen, like, even DeepSeek or OpenAI, all these companies caught up. And how is a company gonna get exclusive access to all this data exclusively? Either you train from simulation, which is every company will be able to replicate that if we're training from simulation. The other solution is real world deployment. And if they need to scale from real world deployment, that actually benefits us as a company because they need hundreds of thousands of robots to scale into the market, or even thousands. So then we're going to have more demand for our robots, if anything, if it's real world deployment that is the factor that wins. And the third part is, okay, let's say they're a foundation model and there are any hardware companies can integrate to them. The hardware companies that's going to win are the ones that already established their production line. So they already have those unit economics and scales. Incumbents are going to struggle to enter the market and establish that reliability. And then third is trust. There is a lot of brand credibility that has to be built over many years, because when factories are choosing robots to buy nowadays, they choose KUKA, they choose Fanuc, because there's already this brand credibility. They don't really care about saving $5,000 on a unit, because they end up losing more time on developer. And then the third part is, the third model is support network. We'll have relationships with all these manufacturing integrators throughout the entire US. And for a Chinese company to kind of like establish those support networks, it's going to take them a lot of time and there's going to be a lot of resistance. And if we're building these moats early on, when these foundation models become ready, think about it. You're a physical AI company. You want to take this foundation model from physical AI, and you need a hardware system to deploy their physical model to. And now you can solve, let's say, busing tables at restaurants. Okay, you're gonna need robot support throughout the whole world, so you can expand. If you just pick a company that only has like a fulfillment center in the Bay Area, that's gonna bottleneck your company. That's why you got to pick us, because we have partners throughout the whole US so that you can scale immediately and not have to worry about hardware as a problem. And that's the value add that we add as a company.
Generally, if we study startups in history, distribution ultimately ends up mattering. Yeah. And what I greatly worry about is if there isn't a novel value prop that sort of, and this goes back to kind of the earliest theme, if we can't find the initial wedge or sort of the opportunity in which there's a uniquely differentiated value proposition with the existing market, the ability to disrupt the existing kind of distribution channels that these companies have, it becomes very, very difficult, especially if you don't own the intelligence layer and we're ultimately selling the actual hardware itself. So I guess the feedback or the area that I would want to ultimately see a startup that's sort of pursuing this space is having a very clear wedge in which the differentiation of the value prop is made abundantly clear to the customer, and they're able to leverage that as to kick off that sort of that flywheel and kind of ultimately expand and build from. But the general takeaway here is also, I don't know how much margin there is ultimately to give to build a large enduring business here. Like, that is still unclear to me of how a company that's sort of servicing the thing within the part of the ecosystem that you'll be sitting in can ultimately build a large enduring business.
So,
and is the biggest,
go ahead.
Is the biggest question around that, because defensibility you're still questioning on, and then just the margins of hardware in general are going to be.
Yeah, exactly. I think when you were, so maybe we'll use an example, like you are a customer and you ultimately today pay some employee an hourly wage, right? Because that is ultimately the wallet share you're going after, right? What is the cost of physical labor in the world today? Now, your replacement of this robot is going to be sold. You can come up with novel business models, but there's going to be some sort of CapEx like purchase that they're ultimately making. Now, the customer, if the cost is too exorbitantly expensive and they can't justify the productivity gains, they're never going to make the switch, right? That's ultimately the sort of floor of what something like this is going to be. So then you're thinking through, okay, well, given the amount of total amount of money I can go after, some of that ultimately needs to feed back to these model providers, right? Some of that ultimately needs to come in from my ability to actually build this hardware. And some of that needs to sort of be priced beyond what it costs me to service it. And that's going to be the margin that I'm going after. My subjective bias at the moment is that the model provider will ultimately capture more of it than the actual ultimate hardware provider itself. So trying to understand if that is the profile of a business here, what ultimately needs to be true in order for this to be worth, you know, tens of billions of dollars, as we kind of talked about, which is generally the type of investments that a venture investor is looking for.
So I don't think the model provider will capture the most value. I think the hardware provider captures a lot of value. So we make about $10,000 in profit per unit we sell. And currently we sell our units for $35,000, which is one of the most affordable.
But what's the payback period now from a physical labor perspective? That's like a...
Yeah, so it actually is $3.50. So the payback period is usually less than a year. Because if you actually run like four of our robots, we actually have a spreadsheet calculation on this where we actually, by deploying our robots, you actually save versus four full-time employees, you actually save about $280,000 a year.
Now, there have been, the idea of selling CapEx for automation is not a new concept, right? A lot of customers have historically been pitched this, and I would almost argue the number of customers that have actually seen the ROI benefits of this thus far are not as many as we'd like. And this has historically been one of the frustrations of a lot of automation companies, where you provide the vision of, oh, look at the cost savings you ultimately realize, but maintenance, servicing, et cetera, ends up really eating into those margins over time. So what gives you conviction that this time is different?
Well, I think that we've also seen automations have been very successful at saving companies money, right? If you actually look at China or like, and they have lower wage costs, they're almost fully automated in their factories. So I would say there is, I do agree that there is a hesitancy for a lot of companies to switch to full automation, but I disagree with the premise that automation has not paid off for the capital expenditure or the capital investment, because historically it has paid off.
What are some of the automation companies you look up to as having done this incredibly well?
I think ABB and Panic has done this incredibly well because they just built a general purpose arm and they work with a lot of manufacturing integrators as the wedge for kind of like, hey, how do we integrate this into these different factories? And then these manufacturing integrators, they use their API and then they just custom program it, and these companies are worth billions of dollars today.
I agree. I think when you think about an ABB, though, that company was probably founded in, and I would definitely want to fact check this, but it's probably been around for about 100 years or so.
Yeah.
So it's not historically what I would fall as a venture-backed startup in the sort of duration and timeline, which is also one of the other hardest constraints is it's not just the value creation, it's the time to that value creation mechanism it needs to follow, which historically is the hard part about automation.
Yeah.
So I'd love, just as you kind of think through this, and this is almost like studying from history, studying from the greats, learning why now is a really important piece, and understanding if there is an opportunity to really create in the customer's mind not just the fact that automation will at some point benefit them, but the short feedback loop that it's already benefiting them and that they're already seeing those sort of labor savings. That I think is a really key piece to driving meaningful adoption to ultimately build the sort of distribution that you aspire to. This is a very compelling opportunity. There's going to be a lot of startups that are converging onto it. I think the startups that ultimately differentiate are ones who can both align incentives in addition to building great technology. I think
you're saying this is a venture. There is a venture fundable opportunity around here.
There could be. There absolutely could be. But I don't think the pattern that has historically led to I'm going to build a robot and I think it requires innovating on the business model side as much as it involves innovating on the technology side. There's a whole world of like systems integrators that exist today in the world of implementation. And they have done interesting things around asset-based financing where, you know, you pay them essentially almost as if you're paying people on an hourly wage, and they try to, there's creative like financing kind of mechanisms. And I'm happy to talk about certain companies that have done that. But I think success here will be predicated on more than just building amazing technology. And I just sort of wanted to kind of push you in that direction.
No, I think that's what makes Feather unique. We are open to exploring different business opportunities. And I think that our entire differentiator is we're very unique in our go-to-market. And that's why we're working with manufacturing integrators as a wedge. And we're going to figure out how do we align incentives? So I think that...
And those LOIs, are those from... integrators?
Yes, those are from integrators as well as physical AI startups.
Yeah.
So
that's great.
That's really cool. I mean, that's confirmation. Yeah. Hawad just left the room and Shaq and I are about to have a one-on-one conversation about the pitch.
What I always tell my founders to do is like, rather than starting in PowerPoint, start in a Word doc and write three bullet points. That is literally it. Just write three bullet points. And those three bullet points are like, if the person on the other side gets anything out of this discussion, they should know these three things. Anything else that they got, that's all bonus. But like the only three things that matter are the three bullet points that I'm writing here.
And that can vary based on whatever the business is.
Exactly. In this case, like...
What would it be for Hua?
Yeah, it's a good question. One would be the future of robotics. The limitation on robotics will not be a function of the complexity of the hardware. It'll be because of the simplicity of the hardware, right? That's one of his bullet points. And it took me a bit to get that out of him, to be clear. I had to really work there. And at least this is my understanding of what he wants to build. I think he thinks that the figures of the world are almost over-engineering for this like absolutely perfect humanoid. And his belief is that you can do it much, much more cheaply using more scrappy creative form factors. The like one arm on the roller cart that he showed us, like the entire thing, my guess is he mentioned he could sell it with $10,000 margins, which means his all-in costs are probably in the order of like $20,000, right? That is a order of magnitude probably less than his than these other companies that are trying to build this, right? So he thinks that scrappy, like cheap hardware with just flood the world with them, put a million of these devices everywhere, collect as much data as you possibly can in the real world, and that will continue to further improve robotics. Like that is one of his bullet points, right? His other bullet points are probably around, like you have to absolutely build an amazing developer experience. Like you have to make sure that folks are coming in. And again, these things were implicit, not explicit. And unfortunately, most people don't have the attention span to pay attention to actually draw those out of people, right? So the feedback to him is figure out what those three bullet points are, make them incredibly explicit, and make sure at the very least, I might disagree even after hearing those three bullet points. That is totally fine. That is ultimately the world we live in, right? But it is a mistake on his part if he walks out of that, and I can't articulate what those three things were.
The more that I see interviews like this and just being previously a VC, it's like there's something that VCs are assuming about you, and those three need to speak to that. And I'm curious, in Hua's case, what would be the three things that when you're describing his opportunity to another partner? Yeah, I'm just curious.
It's I like to call this it's the cocktail description, right? So oftentimes when you're at a networking event or you're seeing a bunch of other VCs, you'll start trading names of companies. And you'll be like, oh, did you see, oh, that's the company that's building, you know, Scale AI for robotics, or that's the company that's building X for Y, you know? And if you walk out of a pitch and you can't necessarily articulate like, what is the like cocktail version of that company, then to me, it probably means that the person didn't really understand what you were building, right? So his sort of cocktail description, I would say, is commodity hardware with a great like developer SDK is sort of what I believe he's trying to build. I probably am not doing it full justice or appreciation of the nuance.
It's about making it easy for you to be able to articulate that at the end of the day.
We're all playing this game of telephone, right? And how do I then tell the next person what it is? And then that creates the virality, or that, did you see that this company's out there and what are they doing again? Oh yeah, they're doing this for this. Oh, okay. That makes a lot of sense. So that I think is the markings of a really good pitch. When everyone walks out of the call and they know more or less exactly what you're trying to do. The founders that most resonate with me are the ones when I bring up other companies in their broad value chain, rather than being dismissive or saying that, oh, we're going to like, I think it's important to understand incentives. Ultimately, there's a famous Charlie Mungerism that you show me the incentive and I'll show you the outcome. And I think that is exceptionally true in startups. So based on how much a company has raised, based on the type of talent they've attracted, based on what they've publicly said, there's a lot to show you there about what ultimately their aspirations are and what they plan on building. And the best, the top decile founders are the ones who navigate through all of that. They're obsessed. They're paying attention to every little clip and everything that comes out of it. And they understand exactly what they're building and how it fits into the broad ecosystem. So there's an aspect of studying history. It's like learning kind of who's come before me, what were their assumptions that they made, what ended up being proven true, what ended up being proven false. But I find that those founders almost always are the ones that I get most excited about spending time with, the ones that are obsessed with their ecosystem, their value chain, and have studied the sort of history patterns that have led them to there.
Interesting. For some reason, I'm thinking about like the first Antarctica expedition where there was multiple people who had tried before. And it's easy to be the one now is like, we're different just because we're smarter and we're better. But you're saying it would be much more interesting to you to say, hey, these three expeditions failed here and we studied where they went wrong.
That's exactly right. Exactly right. It's like, oh, and also they probably made this assumption because based on his map, he would have been told that the sea levels were going to be explicitly this level at this point. And so they actually tried to navigate around it. But in reality, actually, what I believe to be true is that you want to go through the sea level because there's some, I'm trying to run with this analogy. I'm sorry if it's not working.
No, it's you're killing me.
but that's the point. Exactly. Yeah. I think it's the ability to be able to study what's come before you, understand why they may have done what they've done, and learn from that versus dismissive.
That is good. This is just blowing up my mind right now because I'm like, that it makes so much sense, because I think in the same reason that the best startups are the ones that learn from their mistakes. How better is it to learn from those?
There's a really good example of a company called General Magic. I don't know if you're there's a great documentary on them. I would recommend all very few founders, I think, of today's era probably would have ever learned about this. But the iPhone was invented before the iPhone, right? This was – it had everything you could have possibly asked for. They had access to essentially infinite amount of capital. They had the absolute best of the best from a talent perspective. They were working in like what is a huge market. So like if you were to draw the like – check, check, check of everything. Like this company should have succeeded. We should all be using a General Magic phone at the moment, yet we're not. And
what year was it?
This probably would have been just before, probably like early 2000s. So like maybe about 3 to 4 years, probably too early. And ultimately that was the conclusion, right? It is timing is a bit of everything. And they ended up having to vertically integrate beyond what a startup should have, right? Everything from like setting up the telecommunications infrastructure to actually building the device to rolling out the operating system. There was just too much to be done, and not one company should have been taking that whole thing on, right? But that's an example of something where the ambition is important, but it's also scaled ambition relative to the opportunity and kind of knowing what it was. Now, Steve Jobs would come around several years later, knowing exactly what resources he had access to and was able to build the greatest consumer product of all time. So that is like a small example of kind of what I'm touching on, where it's if I'm
scaled because of X, Y, and Z, and the reasons were outside infrastructure. Now that's been solved.
Yeah.
If you're Apple years later and we're still, if they had just taken the same product and but built it now for the most part, which
that's
is
right.
What
Apple that's right. That's right. So,
but it's understanding that context, and it's understanding the actual learnings that happened before where people were trying to sell a product.
Totally. I rarely have heard an idea or a pitch that I'm like, that is the first time I've ever heard that. Like, we like to think about venture as being so disruptive and novel, but I think it's not so much the idea being disruptive and novel. It's the operationalizing of that idea that finally the timing is everything, right? The difference between being early and being wrong, unfortunately, there isn't one, right? Right. And that I think is an important lesson for founders that are ultimately trying to build something.
What are you excited about in hardware that is changing? Like obviously the AI component of it, but like you touched on how you thought the real opportunity was around the intelligence layer versus the hardware. Is there anything else you can tell about where you see things going in the next 5 years, these shifts to help founders who are building around that?
Yeah, look, I think this is probably like one of the, if not the single most exciting place folks can be building in today. So
hardware.
Generalized physical intelligence, I should say. I think one of the questions that we have to ask ourselves, going back to this theme we just discussed, is how do we make sure we're not too early? Well, it's important to to watch very closely what is actually happening. So in the world of large language models, we had access to all of human history, right? And that is this beautiful thing called the internet. Everything that was uploaded, all of human knowledge was basically in the single place. Now, the incentives that led to that is that there was no cost to create information and there was no cost essentially to distribute information. So it had this inherent sort of quality where everyone just started putting everything on there. And these amazing research labs all came around and realized we have access to this. It's not unique that we have access to it. Everyone else has access to it too. But if we take it and we focus singularly on building these amazing capabilities, we have these amazing models that we have today. Now, if we look at physical labor as a parallel to that, we do not have that same access. We don't have the internet of robotics data today. So as I talk with great entrepreneurs and I ask, you know, like where is your conviction coming from? There's almost like an inherent assumption that we have the foundation model for robotics today. But the question there is, where is a lot of data that still needs to be generated there? And there's not just the data that needs to be generated. What is the incentive for generating that data? Every time you run some sort of telerobotics or you run some sort of operation, there is a cost associated with that, right? Let's use self-driving really quick as a counterexample. So in self-driving, you have the two largest players that were basically being funded by balance sheets that were not venture-funded balance sheets, like Google, who was basically, you know, funding the cost of Waymo, and, you know, General Motors, who would then go on to fund, you know, the cost of Cruise. Amazon has their own version in a company called Zooks. But this was a game meant for titans because they understood that to create the data required at scale, you needed essentially access to a massive balance sheet to go and do that because there was no incentive to do that. Now, who is the counter orthogonal point of view here? It's Tesla, right? The vision that Tesla has is I have already equipped all of these cars that are already driving out there on the road with computer vision, and they can be a vehicle, no pun intended, to collect a bunch of visual data. So if I can scale that up in a way, maybe I can arrive at the same fully self-driving, you know, world that these others have tried to build, but through an incentive that looked very, very different than paying people essentially to go and drive a car around San Francisco all day, right? Now let's play that forward in robotics. The area in robotics that, you know, who ultimately today, you've got a lot of companies that want to go to lower cost labor countries and ultimately provide some capability to allow people to like operate robots all day, every day. Now, even if you do that for, you know, months, years, et cetera, the ability to recreate the internet scale data is unlikely to be true, right? We need some sort of incentive breakthrough. So the founders I'm really excited about are ones who are cleverly thinking about this. How do you create this data? How do you label this data? How do you ultimately provide this data? Whether you want to be a research lab yourself, whether you want to sell into these research labs. But as we can embody that level of intelligence into these models, that's where all of a sudden things get very, very exciting. And for me, one of the pieces is like timing. Timing is everything.
Because the biggest challenge right now is getting the data.
I'm not expecting to be right about everything, but this is a point of view that I have. And I, you know, intellectually want to be challenged on what assumptions has he seen through his experience that would then push me to think that, oh, actually, we will get to that data, or we're going to have some massive algorithmic breakthrough, or we're going to scale telerobotics in a way we've never scaled it before.
It makes a lot of sense because the challenge is not, can you build a thing that works as a robot? It never has really been. It's, can you understand all the different variables of things? And we have no way of tracking that right now because there's not a bunch of stuff on our bodies as we do all the things throughout our day. So that is like siloed, dark information.
That's right.
And that's the biggest thing that AI has done is that we already had it. It was all like for the internet, for all those writing problems.
We had all knowledge work, right? And I think this is the most important piece is if you want to build a domain-specific robot, which is something I was really kind of pushing him on, I think the amount of scale data you need to collect in that domain is not as large as the internet scale. We can build purpose-built robots much more quickly than we want to build a generalizable robot, a robot that can essentially zero shot a new task that it has never seen before. But the way a human would look at an object and say, oh, I can pick it up with this much force, and this is ultimately how it'll move. That generalizability is it's ambitious. It's what we all want. We want to build physical world robots with that. But that is not a variable that you can kind of, or that is a variable. It's not a constant. You can just like kind of plug into your equation and say, yep, that's solved. Let's move on.
That makes a lot of sense. It's the same problem. Like I always try to automate any steps in my current workflow, but the problem is that I'm constantly changing. So if I don't have a way to, so like the automations fail and break, it's almost like we can get a robot to do the same thing, no problem.
That's right.
But the variability, which is, it's like the Waymo, and then there's like a kid and they're a different size and they didn't have that in the algorithm.
That's right.
And you just can't have it. And that's the problem.
Yeah. And this is why not all use cases are the same. This is what makes it exciting. So one way to think about this is, when you are AWS and you're standing up a some sort of cloud server, you will sell your customers what are called the nines of availability, right? So it's 99.99999% available, which means that over the course of a year, you might have single digit number of minutes of downtime, right? And most people are okay with that. They know it might not occur linearly, it might just get distributed across the year, but like that is expected downtime. Self-driving is one of those use cases where if you go wrong, it's existential, right? So you have to make sure the nines of availability are there. Not all physical labor robotic use cases have that same shared quality. There are some that could be down, you know, your janitorial robot could potentially go down more frequently, and that's not mission critical. There are other robots where they need as much of the nines of availability as possible. So that aspect of how much data is required, how much of those sort of corner cases do I need to train on and build into the model, that will vary greatly, which is why it's important to know what is the use case I'm ultimately going after, and then what is then the data collection required to service that use case.
Boom. Thank you.
Yeah.
That was amazing. I'm Adam O'Donnell. Thanks for listening to the Founder Initiative. Reach out to me on LinkedIn. This is way more than just a podcast. It's a community of founders where we're dedicated to focusing on helping founders hit product market fit, get funded, and stay up to date. Boom.